morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A former Malawi lawmaker commits suicide in Parliament.
Yeah, I would say that there is negligence in terms of how security should be provided in those vulnerable and high-risky places like Parliament. This should be a wake-up call.
Banned political party groups in Eswatini will present a petition to the U.S. Embassy today, Friday. Traditional hunters in southwest Burkina Faso prepare to face terrorist threat. Nigerian police denied killing members of a banned Shiite Muslim group. And Ethiopia expels 7 top UN officials.
The Commission of Inquiry, for the moment, has not received support from the African Union. And I think here we're talking about both political, financial, logistical support.
And rising home invasions in Johannesburg, South Africa. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A former high-ranking lawmaker in Malawi has committed suicide in the country's parliament building. The former second deputy speaker of parliament, Clement Chiwaya, 50 years old, fatally shot himself on Thursday afternoon while inside the National Assembly. Islamic Masina reports from Blantyre. The incident is raising concerns about security in the parliament.
Details about what led Chiwaya to shoot himself in the head with a pistol remains sketchy. The parliament said in a statement, the public will be informed at an appropriate time as the matter is currently being investigated by the Malawi Police Service. Chiwaya was a former lawmaker who represented the opposition United Democratic Front Party. At the time of death, he was no longer in office. According to the statement from parliament, Chiwaya recently was involved in a court case regarding his vehicle. The car was in an accident before the transfer of ownership was completed and the insurance had expired. Chiwaya sought help from the government's office of ombudsman, who made a determination in his favor, but Malawi's High Court set the determination aside. The parliament statement said guards have the proper equipment and protocols to ensure safety in the building. However, Chiwaya's suicide has raised concerns. Former military officer Sherif Kaisi is a security expert based in Blantyre.
To me, I would say that there is negligence in terms of how security should be provided in those vulnerable and high-risky places like the parliament. This should be a wake-up call. In the management of security, there is no way you can manage security in that sense that you have cameras and detectors.
Chiwaya has been in a wheelchair for a number of years. In its statement, the National Assembly said that while Chiwaya set off alerts when he passed through metal detectors Thursday, the alerts were deemed to be from the wheelchair and therefore guards did not look for any firearms. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
The Ethiopian government says it is expelling 7 top officials of UN humanitarian agencies. The government accuses the officials of meddling in the country's affairs. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he is shocked by the accusations and that the UN is talking with Ethiopia to allow the officials to continue their work. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Through its Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ethiopia's government on Thursday announced the expulsion of 7 high-ranking officials with UN humanitarian agencies. The government accused aid workers of interfering with its internal affairs without elaborating. Those expelled include Adele Koda, UN Children's Fund representative in Ethiopia, Sonny Nyegebula, monitoring team leader for the UN Office High Commissioner for Human Rights, and 5 officials with Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, including Peace and Development Advisor Kwesi Sankolot. The government has told the 7 to leave the country within 72 hours. The Horn of African nation is facing internal and external pressure to end the 11-month-old conflict in the Tigray region. Rights groups and aid agencies have documented abuses, rape, looting and blockade of humanitarian convoys. In June, the African Union launched a commission of inquiry to look into human rights abuses in Ethiopia. Speaking in an online news conference Thursday, Letitia Bada, Human Rights Watch, Horn of Africa chief, said African investigators need support from all 55 countries on the continent.
The commission of inquiry for the moment has not received support from the African Union. And I think here we're talking about both political, financial, logistical support. I think it's absolutely key that the AU at the highest level is providing that to the commission of inquiry.
The Ethiopian government launched a military operation last year against the Tigray region after months of disagreement over security, politics and the future of the country. The US government has threatened to sanction individuals seen as responsible for conflict and for blocking food, medicine from reaching those in need. The Ethiopian government says it is allowing aid food to pass, but aid agencies said authorities need to do more. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, banned political party groups, including the People's United Democratic Movement, PUDEMO, plan to petition the U.S. Embassy today, Friday. The groups want the embassy to put pressure on the administration of King Mswati III to lift the ban on them and allow more democratic reforms. This after expressing concern that the international community does not seem to be urging the government to allow its citizens to choose their own leaders and be democratic like in other African countries. PUDEMO recently launched a series of protests to demand democratic reforms, but they were stopped by the police who arrested members of the group. For more about today's petition, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Sibusiso Siyaya, spokesperson for PUDEMO in the Eswatini capital, Mbabane.
Yes, absolutely, it is true. PUDEMO will be joining other political formations and other progressive formations in Swaziland to a protest march to the U.S. Embassy, to call on the U.S. Embassy to try and fast-track the process of the monarchy and the regime in Swaziland for it to be able to engage in a dialogue with the people of Swaziland.
But why the protest? Because several attempted protests have been prevented by the authorities. So why do you think this will be successful?
Definitely, you are right. We must agree to say we have also realized we've been doing so many protests. But amongst other things which we feel like maybe our protest seems not to be yielding the results in which we are expecting it to yield, is also based on that some international bodies, they are simply too blind and not so much willing in terms of taking an initiative to defend human rights in countries such as Swaziland. But then that does not demoralize us. I think the protests, they play a prominent role, especially in terms of ensuring that the morale is always high within our people, and also to ensure that the environment in Swaziland must not be normal when the circumstances and conditions our people are subjected to are so abnormal.
But you cannot fault foreign embassies operating in Eswatini to say they have turned a blind eye, because they cannot be seen as interfering in the internal dynamics of Eswatini or Swaziland, as you call it.
So, but you will agree with me, Peter, that protests and demonstrations that are happening in any country are another way of communicating in terms of the feelings and wills of the people, especially the oppressed people of that country. So these protests are a true reflection and a way in which our people are communicating that the environment they are subjected to, it is not out in their interest. Hence, therefore, we then believe that any pro-democratic formation or existing institution in the world will definitely wish and try its level best in terms of trying to also assist and give support when necessary.
Sibusiso, what is contained in this petition that you plan to hand over to the U.S. Embassy today, Friday?
It is to call upon the country of Swaziland to unban all political parties and call an all-inclusive dialogue also democratic constitution in a multi-democratic dispensation, and also to try and request the U.S. Embassy to also try in all structures within the international community and within itself to make the government of our country account for the serious violations of the human rights in this country. You remember that we have over 70 lives that have been lost due to protests that our people had engaged to, and as well appoint in terms of trying to also do independent investigations in terms of how these ruthless killings happened in this country.
Sibusiso Siyaya is the spokesperson for the People's United Democratic Movement, also known as PUDEMO, of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Mbabane. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 1st. Analysts say Burkina Faso's six-year conflict with terrorist groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda is spreading to the country's southern region. Reporter Henry Wilkins went on a patrol with a group of vigilantes as they prepare to defend against the Islamist militants and files this report from the southern town of Bobo-Dioulasso.
Just outside Burkina Faso's second largest city, dozos, or hunters who traditionally kill animals for food and provide basic security to the countryside, are preparing to face a new threat, terrorists linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Primarily isolated to the north and east of the country in the past, analysts say Burkina Faso's six-year conflict is now spreading to the southwest, where it borders Ghana, Ivory Coast, Togo and Benin. Blaise Sanou is a local dozo leader.
Bon, ça c'est ceux qui ont les moyens.
The majority of our guns are shotguns, he says, and questions how they'll be able to fire at someone 300 meters away. He says the situation is difficult, and they need military training as well as weapons to be able to put up a defense. With an overstretched military, the country has come to rely on civilian militias, armed and trained by the government in the north and east, to act as auxiliaries and assist the military. Analysts say it is likely the dozos will play a military role in the southwest too, although similar groups have been criticized for acting as vigilantes and carrying out extrajudicial killings. Sanou thinks that terrorism in the southwest is not a religious problem, but caused by people who are looking for something else. That is, money to satisfy their needs, he says. Without enough money to get by, they kill people to get it. The domain is usually drugs, and anywhere there is gold, they look for opportunities. They even take animals to eat or sell, he adds. A Burkinabe analyst says that just 15% of terrorists are in fact religious fanatics. Jacob Urede Batiola, an expert on terrorist groups at Ouagadougou University, believes other factors such as poverty and lack of development push individuals into terror groups.
Je pense qu'il faut situer ce mouvement.
He thinks the terrorist movements in the west of Burkina Faso need to be put in context too. There have been incursions of terrorist attacks in Ivory Coast, in Grand Bassam, he points out. Because of these incursions, it now seems possible terrorism could spread beyond the Sahel to the Atlantic coast, where they can carry out attacks from. He believes to slow down the descent of the southwest into terrorism, the intelligence service and special forces units need to take action. For his part, one of the dozos, Ernest Fassa Sanou, says he feels compelled to defend the country no matter what. Almost every child among us is born a dozo, he says, because our parents were hunters. It's a bit like a heritage, so the dozo brotherhood is adhered to. People think it's new, whereas even before our grandparents were hunters, before the name dozo came into being. But with little military training and inferior equipment, it is unclear what kind of defence the dozos will be able to mount. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Bobo-Dioulasso, Burkina Faso.
Nigerian police have denied killing any members of a banned Shiite Muslim group during a gathering this week in the capital, Abuja. The Islamic Movement of Nigeria says police on Tuesday shot and killed 8 of their members as they marked the religious ritual of Arbaeen. Security forces have previously fired on events by the IMN, which is taking the case to court. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigerian educator Naomi Ibrahim opened Kelta Primary School in Kaduna State 7 years ago after an attack by Boko Haram militants forced her to flee her hometown in Borno State. She says the aim is to help children affected by conflict get a basic education. But waves of violence and mass kidnappings are threatening her work and keeping students away.
Some from Borno, some from Adamawa, some are from Gombe and other places like that. We are just praying. It is God that is keeping us safe.
Ibrahim says only 50 of about 120 students appeared for the new term, which began last week. She blames insecurity in the region for the low attendance. Kaduna is one of the state's worst hit by mass school kidnappings that began in northern Nigeria late last year. Since December, the government reports more than 1,000 school children have been seized from schools in the region. The kidnappings are usually carried out by bandits, local criminal gangs demanding ransom from the victims' families. Other states affected include Niger, Zamfara, and Katsina. To address the problem, Kaduna state authorities closed schools in July, but reopened them this month, saying the situation had improved. Community leader Abu Mohammed agrees.
There's an upgrade, really, in the issue of security attention from the government. Why? Because the governor himself has a call, has made a very good clarion call from all the security apparatus. And they have all gathered here in Kaduna. They have gone into the forest to see where their stations are.
But Aisha Tumusa says the fear that bandits could kidnap her children from school has not gone away. She said, "I'm scared about what is happening now. That's why I don't want them to go to school yet." 2 weeks ago, UNICEF estimated 1 million Nigerian children could miss out on education due to security concerns. The agency estimates Nigeria has the greatest number of out-of-school children in the world, about 13.2 million. UNICEF Nigeria's education manager, Rudra Sahu, says the actual figure could be even higher.
In the months of May, June and July, there are regular attacks, particularly in the North Central and Northwest region. And as a precautionary measure, nearly 11,000 schools closed during that time. All these schools are open now, but still the apprehension on the mind of parents is there.
For now, schools like Kelta Primary School will carry on with classes, despite uncertainty about whether it is safe to do so. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Police and private security groups are reporting an alarming increase in violent home invasions in South Africa's biggest city, Johannesburg. According to international law enforcement agencies, South Africa is one of the world's most crime-ridden countries, with violent offenses such as murder and rape common. Now, as police step up efforts to prevent high-profile crimes such as cash-in-transit heists, it appears as if gangs are turning their attention to easier targets. Darren Taylor reports.
The Beagle Watch armed response firm is just one of many private security companies in Johannesburg reporting a sudden spate of attacks on private homes.
Elderly folks seem to have been targeted by either working at home in their gardens or generally around the home when perhaps they're not aware of their surroundings.
Beagle Watch MD Andre Ayton says the gangs are needlessly assaulting their elderly victims. In one case, he says, a man was beaten so badly that all his ribs were broken and he lost all his teeth, and a woman was left blind.
It is shocking news for us in terms of the amount of incidents we are having where the actual elderly folk are having to be treated by health practitioners on the scene of these violent crimes that are taking place.
Ayton's concerned that Johannesburg residents aren't taking security seriously enough, despite knowing they live in one of the most violent, crime-infested places on earth.
I think one of the most fundamental aspects to our crime today is the complacency levels that we have within our residents and within society. We become complacent and we present ourselves to the criminals. We only seem to attack the problem and address the problem once we've become a victim of crime.
He says South Africans have to realize they don't live in a normal society with normal crime levels. For that reason, he urges them to get expert training in how to handle crimes such as home invasions and how to draw up family plans in the event of a gang attack on their homes.
Most of the cases that I arrive on the scenes, there is absolutely no plan in place, and it is a traumatic experience that somebody will live for the rest of their life. I also refer to opening up of gates to service providers that perhaps arrive at your property. We live in a society at the moment, this is a no-go area. And I urge the elderly and residents, what is most important is that you sit your family down and make the investment of time and have a plan in place should you become a victim.
Ayton agrees that any normal person would panic when confronted by violent thugs. But he says it is possible for families to impress upon themselves to remain as calm as possible if this happens and to cooperate with the criminals. He says during robberies, the criminals are themselves under severe pressure that often causes them to crack and become even more prone to extreme violence. Ayton says the police and private security companies are dedicated to breaking the home invader gangs.
We follow up on every lead that we have. We analyze the data that we are gathering through these robberies. We make use of sophisticated camera systems to try and understand the modus of operandi, who was involved, what routes did they follow, what vehicles are being used, can the vehicle be flagged, is it a stolen vehicle? So there's a lot of work.
He says the stress that South Africans, especially those in big cities, are under because of crime is unprecedented, making for a society that's deeply traumatized. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Somalia has opened its first public oxygen plant, which officials say will help save lives threatened by COVID-19. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia is battling to control a third wave of COVID-19 infections throughout the country. The battle got a little easier this week with the opening of country's first oxygen plant. Abdullahi Osman, an official with Hormuz Salam Foundation, which funded the project, say the plant will save the government the cost of importing oxygen. He said the plant will produce 1,008 oxygen cylinders a week, each with 50 liters, saving $50,000 a week, which translates to $2.6 million annually for health facilities in the country. The Minister for Health, Dr. Fauzia Noor Abikar, urged the private sector to exercise their social responsibilities and help the government expand capacity to better deal with the pandemic. She says the oxygen plant is a big relief for Mogadishu, which has over 3 million residents. She said they expect more factories to open in coming weeks to respond to the need, both in the capital and other parts of the country. The director of Banadir Maternal Hospital, where some of the patients with breathing problems were treated, said the precious commodity will save lives. She said her facility has lost several patients, mainly women and children, due to lack of oxygen, while forcing others to share oxygen concentration to save lives. Health authorities say that within the last week, 8 people lost their lives to the virus with 257 new infections. Somalia's overall death toll from the pandemic stands at just over 1,100. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
And that's it for this Friday, October 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Button in Washington, wishing you a very, very good weekend.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.